Welcome to the Organic Gardener Podcast. I'm your host, Jackie Marie Beyer. Let's get growing.
Hi, listeners. I'd like to invite you to visit our website at organicgardenerpodcast.com, where you can sign up for our newsletter, download our ebook on organic gardening basics, and get started on building your very own organic oasis today. Welcome to the show today. I am super excited to introduce my guest who was, we were connected through a fellow teacher. Rebecca Mitchell works for the Green Mountain Farm to School program. So we're going to learn about, two of my passions, teaching kids and also gardening. So welcome to the show today, Rebecca.
Thanks. I'm excited to be here.
Cool. Well, we're excited to have you and learn about how we can, you know, promote gardening and healthy food in our schools. So why don't you go ahead and tell us a little bit about yourself first, and then we'll talk about the program.
Great. So my name is Rebecca Mitchell. I grew up in Burlington, Vermont, and the last about 2.5 years, I've been living and working in the Northeast Kingdom of Vermont. So that's the three northeastern counties in the state of Vermont up by the Canadian border. I have a background in environmental science and got into education actually working as support staff at a preschool when I was a college student. And from there, my path led me to farm-based education, which led to farm-to-school programming, working with mostly elementary school-age children, connecting them to where their food comes from through hands-on learning experiences, cooking, gardening, all kinds of good things like that.
Awesome. Okay. So I do always kind of like to start the show asking my guest about their very first gardening experience. So do you want to tell us, like, you know, how old were you? Where were you? Who were you with? Like, what'd you grow? Like, what was your very first gardening experience?
Yeah, I love that question. So I was born in Allentown, Pennsylvania, which is more of an urban area than Vermont. And I remember having a small garden in our backyard. I lived with my parents and my grandparents. And we had had, I remember tomatoes predominantly, and loving eating fresh tomatoes from the yard. And I was really fascinated by that growing process. So my family ended up creating a little garden plot for me where I got to kind of tinker with planting seeds and trying to grow things. It wasn't super successful because I was pretty young at that point, but it was nice being able to get outside, play in the dirt, attempt to grow some things. And from there, I think my interests have continued to grow, and my knowledge of gardening has certainly expanded from there as well.
Okay. Tell us a little bit about how you became an environmental studies major, because I had the environmental studies teacher from U of M, which is where I went to school, the University of Montana, on, and I was telling her that, like, when I first moved to Montana, I had no idea, like, that there was such a thing as an environmentalist, that you could have an environmental studies major. Like, how'd you learn about that? And maybe things have changed. You know, I went to college 20-something years, almost 30 years ago, probably now. But, like, how did you learn about that and get inspired to choose that as a major?
Yeah, so I went to a pretty small liberal arts school in eastern Pennsylvania, Moravian College. And so part of the curriculum there is really just taking classes through a broad range of disciplines. And my freshman year, I took an intro to environmental studies course and had a really wonderful professor there. And as an intro course, it was a broad overview of environmental issues, but I was really inspired by that. And one of the beauties of a liberal arts education that it's fairly easy. It's pretty fluid. And so I wasn't locked into a major at that point. I went into school undecided, actually leaning towards more of an English degree, but I ended up really loving environmental studies and sciences. So pursued that and had a lot of really wonderful opportunities in school to have hands-on experiential learning. I did an undergraduate research project my junior year of school, studying stream ecology, so catching fish and macroinvertebrate and studying water chemistry in some of the local streams there, as well as doing an internship at a hydroelectric facility my senior year. So I had a really wonderful group of professors and advisors who made following the path to environmental science really easy and exciting for me too. So this has been a little bit of a step going from those kind of water-based sciences to gardening and food education, but it's a path that made sense to me. And I think the background that I got in school has aided me to what I'm doing now in terms of work.
Awesome. I love to hear all those things. And I get so frustrated with kids who are like, oh, I'm not going to go to college because I don't know what I want to be. Because a lot of college is figuring out what do you want to be, what do you not want to be. And it's so interesting. You went from thinking you were going to be an English major to a science and taking all these science classes and studying water chemistry of all things. You know, it really shows you learn so much and college about what you want to do. There's like all these jobs you'd never even heard of, and like you're sitting next to somebody who's like, oh yeah, my cousin's best friend's niece does this, you would love this, and next thing you know you're connected to somebody and doing something you didn't even know existed. So
totally
cool. What a great path. Do you want to tell us what organic gardening or like earth-friendly gardening means to you?
Yeah, I think organic gardening, or I like your term friendly gardening, is really just being conscientious through your gardening and farming practices. As an organization, we do a lot of school gardens, so obviously they aren't certified organic, but we generally follow organic practices in those gardens. And I think just staying with your roots and being respectful and gentle to the earth, especially working with kids, there is really no need for chemicals to go into the gardens where we're working.
And so what kind of things do you plant with the kids? And tell us a little bit about the school gardens that you work on. Do you work at just one school or different schools around? What'd you say? You're in the Northern Kingdom?
That's the Northeast Kingdom, which makes it sound super swanky, exciting. And it is really beautiful. It's kind of the rural northern part of the state. So our program works with, I think, about 25 schools around the area facilitating their school gardens. And that program can vary. Some of the schools, it's just after-school programming where we go in once a week and work with a small group of kids on the garden. For other schools, it's all classes who are involved with that gardening process. Mm-hmm. But generally, we have our pool of AmeriCorps members, and those are our people who are the kind of boots on the ground facilitating those gardens. So that's what I did for the past 2 years. And now I'm in a staff position with the organization. That's a little bit different. But basically you're assigned to three or four different schools, and you're responsible for going out in the fall and harvesting with the kids, washing your harvest, weighing it, bringing it to the school kitchen, food service staff, and that can be integrated into school lunches or into a community dinner during the school's fall open house. So kids are really getting to see a holistic process there. And then in the spring, students get to do seed starting, planning what the garden looks like, and then physically going out and prepping the beds and planting in them. So lots of dirty hands and lots of excitement in the garden.
Okay. So, you know, my big question that's always kind of made me wonder as a teacher and What do you do about the summer? Like, because the summer's when a lot of the work takes place and the kids aren't in school in the summer. Like, how does that piece work?
Totally. Our hope is always to have parents, families, community volunteers coming out to help tend the garden in the summer, depending on the town, interest and availability of people to come out kind of varies. We try to make the garden a community resource and make people feel like it's accessible and they can come and do a little bit of weeding or a little bit of watering, and hopefully giving students and their families ownership over the garden, keeping in mind things happen, people aren't always able to come out. So our staff makes a point to visit the gardens regularly during the summer to help with tending the beds, harvesting as needed, weeding, watering, all those good things. But I think it's an ongoing process to build up those pools of volunteers for the garden.
Okay. How do you guys get funded?
We have funding through a number of different outlets. Our programming, we have a couple of different programs in addition to our actual in-school programs. But we get a lot of grant funding, donations from both kind of corporations and individuals. It varies, and I think probably my supervisor would be the better person to give you the nitty-gritty of okay. where our funding comes from.
That's a good start.
Yeah, for our in-school programming, generally we ask schools to pay like a, I think
oh,
a pretty
okay.
modest yearly fee to kind of cover our cost of mileage and time to come in and supplies related to the garden and the other activities that we facilitate there. But I've heard from schools that it's a pretty like modest fee in comparison to say like what a lot of other things that they have built into their budgets.
Mm-hmm. And then how big is your area if you're covering that big of a, that many schools and that big of an, was it like several, did you say a couple of counties or something? Or?
Yeah, so the Northeast Kingdom is three counties. A lot of our schools are in kind of the middle county there, which is Orleans County, Newport, where our office is located, is in that county. So a lot of our schools are there, and then some in the surrounding two counties, Essex and Caledonia. But it's they're pretty spread out, so our farm school coordinators end up doing a lot of driving over the course of the year to visit all of those sites. Yeah.
But just like a 50-mile radius or 100 or 200-mile radius? Like a, I'm just
oh, probably 50 miles,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And then, so tell us about, like, what kind of things do you plant in the gardens with the kids?
So we have a list of certain crops that are kind of universal across all of our school gardens. And then beyond that, there's flexibility depending on what a food service director is interested in having in their garden, what the kids are really passionate about planting. So of that list that is generally planted in all the school gardens, we always plant garlic in the fall. In the spring, we plant kale, winter squash, tomatoes, carrots, beets, potatoes. Trying to think what else. I think there's a list of about like 10 crops that we always plant, kind of keeping in mind that you don't want to plant all tomatoes and then having blight come and wipe out your entire school garden. So, you know, thinking about diversity of crops, different colors, different textures, making the gardens aesthetically interesting, different kind of growing timelines. So we'll have radishes in the garden and that they grow pretty rapidly, so it's a little more exciting and kids can actually see things coming through a little more quickly. So there's a lot of consideration that goes into what we plant in the gardens. And I think that list has been developed over the course of, you know, the 7 or 8 years that the program has been in place. But we also want to keep in mind the school cooks, if they're the ones who are utilizing what we're harvesting from the garden. We definitely want their input when we're planning what goes into the garden. So if they're really passionate about broccoli or something else, we want to make sure that we have that covered in the garden. So we actually see what gets harvested utilized in school meals.
Okay. I like that. So let's see. So tell us maybe, like, how does it start? Like, how do you approach a school? Like, how do you get schools involved if somebody was interested in, like, starting a program in their community?
Yeah, so once I had kind of started with the organization, we had a lot of schools in place already. Our pool of participants has kind of been built up over the past 8 years or so, but we've definitely seen other schools approaching us who are interested in programming, want to sign on, don't really know where to start. But I think coming from the organizational standpoint and trying to get a school signed on, I think garden-based education and farm-based education can cover a lot of different subjects and disciplines really readily. It's experiential learning, which I'm a big advocate for. But there's science involved, there's mathematics involved. You can integrate history really readily. So I think, the resources and a little bit of startup can take some time. But once you have a garden established or even a small plot, I think the benefits are really apparent. So I think trying to get schools on board with things, it's a pretty easy sell. In my opinion, I also, perhaps coming from Vermont, which is a state that has a lot of momentum behind the farm to school movement, I feel like there's a lot of demand for this kind of programming up here, and which might not be the case in other parts of the country, but I think our organization is working in the northeastern part of the state, and we have a lot of regional organizations around Vermont who are doing similar work in their communities. I just see a lot of benefits to the programming, and I think as long as schools are willing to have invest a little bit of time and money at the beginning, there's a lot of rewards, and it would be pretty easy to get, I think, a parent or community volunteer to help spearhead those initiatives. All it takes is one passionate individual to get things started.
Okay. What do you want to tell? What else do you want to tell us?
Well, I guess I would love to touch base about some of our other programming really quickly. Our organization is Green Mountain Farm to School, and our roots are in the farm to school movement and connecting kids to food and gardens and farms. But we do have a lot of other really great initiatives, which are all interconnected, and I just I'm involved with them, so I guess I just want to mention them really quickly. So we have a statewide campaign called Vermont Harvest of the Month that highlights a different locally in-season fruit or vegetable each month and provides a lot of really wonderful ready-to-go educational materials for schools and other institutions to utilize. We have the Lunchbox, which is our food truck and summer food service program. So each summer we do 10 weeks of free meals for kids, trying to source as many of our ingredients locally as possible. And we also have a food hub called Farm Direct. So helping those schools and retailers, hospitals, other institutions in the area procure local foods. So for the schools, you know, you might be getting 150 pounds of produce out of your school garden any given year. But if you want to supplement that throughout the year with more local produce, we help make that possible. So the farm to school is definitely the backbone of our organization, but we have a lot of other exciting initiatives going on to promote local foods in our communities.
That's awesome, because I think, you know, one of the barriers to starting a garden or a farm is where you're going to sell, where you're going to market your produce. And so you're kind of helping not just the kids at school, but you're also helping the local farmers.
Totally. Yeah. Yeah. It's a mutually beneficial process. So we're seeing our kids getting excited about vegetables. They're growing their own, and then they're seeing really great local foods in their cafeteria every day. And then the farmers who are down the road or the next town over are also getting that economic boost from those additional sales, and it creates an extra market for them to sell their products. So it's really, really awesome, and it's something that I'm excited to be a part of.
Okay. So are there any tips you could give farmers or gardeners if they wanted to become one of your producers? Is there a list of requirements or anything that they have to follow?
So I think we do have some guidelines. We have actually a staff member who whose responsibility is coordinating that food hub, and she has more insights than I do around any of those guidelines. But we have kind of our set of producers, but sometimes we do have farmers call and say, you know, this is what I'm growing, or I have an excess of this certain crop. Do you think you have the flexibility to sell it? And sometimes that's the case. So I think you don't really know until you reach out and ask. And I think we're really lucky to have the Food Hub as a resource in this area. But I think for farmers who are in other parts of the country, it doesn't hurt to make that connection. And even if things don't work out right away, there might be need later down the line when the Food Hub needs winter squash, and then they'll call your farm. So you know, making those connections never hurts.
That's what I always thought we could make I mean I haven't really looked into it enough, but I always thought that just selling carrots and potatoes to the schools would keep somebody busy for a whole season, or keep my husband busy, because, you know, those are things that they use a lot of and they're easy to store, and I've just been trying to figure that piece out. Okay. Tell us about the food truck.
Yeah, I would love to. So the Lunchbox is our food truck. We just wrapped up our third summer of meal service through that. And the truck is it's an old delivery truck that got gutted and refurbished to be a mobile kitchen food truck. And we drive around to three different communities in the summer. Okay. And provide free locally sourced meals for kids. So anyone 18 and under can come during those designated meal service times and get a free meal. It's a summer food service program, so it's federally funded. And we aim to get as many of our ingredients locally as possible. So I think last summer it was probably around 60-65% of our purchases in terms of ingredients and produce was locally grown, nice. Which is great. Yeah. So we have, it's free meals for kids. We also have adult meals for purchase. At pretty reasonable prices. The area where we're working has a lot of poverty and food insecurity. I think it's 1 in 3 kids in the Northeast Kingdom is food insecure. So keeping in mind, during the school year, there are a lot of kids who rely pretty heavily on their school breakfast and lunch. And so during that out-of-school time in the summer, they might not have reliable access to food, and we want to provide
definitely not healthy food.
Yeah, totally. So we want to provide that our meals follow the USDA summer food guidelines. So it kind of hits all of those nutritional markers. It's freshly made. It's locally sourced. It's delicious. I know I ate a lot of food from the truck over the summer, and it's great. And so in addition to the meals, we do little taste tests and cooking demos on site. So there is some hands-on activities for kids and families to participate in. We had a summer reading event where kids got to come and listen to a story and get free books at one point. We had bicycle safety demos, so trying to create a more holistic meal experience. So they're not only coming out and getting a great free meal, but they're also hopefully learning something, having fun, and getting to connect with other members of the community.
Okay. What was the most popular meal of the summer? What do they all like clamor for?
Oh my gosh. we had had a lot of requests for spaghetti and meatballs. So we have, okay. Yeah. So that was one that we actually put on the menu because kids were asking for it. Okay. But we had a variety of meals. Tosca, who was our head cook this summer, was really creative and had great choices for the kids as well as really wonderful options for adults. There is always soup, salad, sandwich available for grown-ups. That was a reasonable price, and it was great. Yeah, we had had a series of different like cold soups and gazpachos, and there was a few grown-ups who were super passionate about that and came out every week to see what the new offering was. Okay. So by the end of summer, we have quite a following built up, and it's nice to see new faces, but also the same families coming back week after week and trying new foods and socializing, and it became a really nice community event.
Okay. Tell us about what the kids were, like some of the lessons that you do with the kids in the garden.
Yeah, so we have some written curriculum that can help guide our garden education. So in the fall, we have a lesson around garlic, which culminates with the group planting garlic for the fall. There can be different activities. I really like being able to harvest with the kids and then make a quick snack with whatever we make. So whether that's a fresh salsa or pulling out carrots from the garden and making hummus or a simple dip to enjoy them with.
Nice. I think because I'm so sick of the schools always serving ranch dressing with the carrots.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, if you have a food processor, it's just a few simple ingredients, and hummus is really easy to make and kids love it. We've made kale pesto, which is super well received.
Oh, I'm gonna have to get that recipe.
Yeah, I can send that your way. Okay, so yeah, I mean, I guess I am a little biased, and I really love tying in cooking activities with garden lessons, just because I just see it as a natural fit, and kids react really positively to cooking and getting a snack at the end of the day. But I think, like I said previously, there's a lot of really easy ways of adding math and counting and measuring to your garden activities, whether it's guessing how much potatoes weigh and then figuring out what the difference is between your guess and what their actual weight is, or measuring the distance between starts that you're planting in the ground. You can tie in history really readily. You can do writing activities.
Wait, tell us how you tie in history.
So I can think about the three sisters concept of gardening.
Oh, awesome.
So,
okay, cool.
Yeah, so I'm thinking about beans, corn, and squash being planted together. That's a historical gardening technique, and I think that might go over the head of kindergartners and first graders, but if you have middle schoolers or older elementary school age students, that's something that they can definitely grasp. And it's a nice kind of historical context of that gardening practice. Vermont in general has a pretty rich agricultural history. So I think beyond gardening, thinking about the history of maple sugaring and dairy and sheep and things like that in our area is provides a lot of inspiration for farm-to-school lessons up here. But yeah, I mean, garden education is really wonderful. And even if it's just getting kids excited about being outside and playing in the dirt, I think that's a win, even if they aren't learning about how people gardened a couple hundred years ago. Just getting, planting that seed, so to speak,
absolutely,
getting interest in gardening is really awesome. And I think this is the time in their lives to get them thinking about where their food comes from.
Because people don't realize how far we're getting away from that and how kids, like I had a guest who works with a school garden here in Montana, and she was saying she got started when she started subbing in the schools and the kids didn't know where a potato came from. And she's like, are you kidding? You don't know that a potato grows in the ground? And she just went from there and has taken it to extreme levels. Her name's Patty Armbrister. And then she went, you know, on to work on getting locally grown meat or, you know, local cattle, because especially Montana is a, you know, big ranching community. Mm-hmm. And she was like, why are we importing beef from Texas instead of, you know, using locally grown? So she worked on that because she even had kids who like wanted to donate the cows from their farms, but then they still couldn't do it because it had to be processed in a, you know, federally approved
You
know, meat processing plant. The nearest plant was so far away that by the time, which I still don't really understand, I'm like, well, how can you haul things from Texas? But I don't know. Somehow they worked it out that now at least they're getting their meat from a local Montana processor.
That's really awesome.
Yeah. And our distances are quite a bit bigger than your distances. So did I ask you to tell us about something that grew really well in your gardens this summer?
You did not, although this summer I was not working in the gardens. I was actually working with the lunchbox, our food truck, so I didn't really get a lot of school garden time this summer. So I'm not sure what our best growing crop was, but I know we just did a lot of cooking activities and taste tests in our schools around kale last month. Our November harvest of the month is kale, and I know a lot of our schools still had that in their gardens. It's one of those crops that only gets a little sweeter once it has a light frost. So that always holds up well and is a favorite among our students. Kale pesto, kale salad, lots of good recipes. So I think that's usually pretty consistently grown well and well received by students.
Nice. That's great, because I would think kale would be a little bit more difficult to get the kids to eat. And I love that kale pesto idea. So I had no idea until I started my podcast that you can make pesto out of anything besides basil.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. I think that's been a more recent discovery for me too. It's been nice working for this organization and making those connections with our different farm school coordinators and school cooks, and lots of creative recipes coming out of those collaborations. But yeah, pesto is wonderful, and it's so versatile. And the kale pesto is super delicious, but I also am just a kale fan in general.
Oh, you are? What
yes.
other things do you like to make with kale?
I mean, it's great just sautéed with a little olive oil and garlic.
Do you make the kale chips? Do you teach the kids how to make kale chips?
Yeah, yeah. Kale chips is great. It's always really well received when we do taste tests in schools with kids.
That's great, because I'm so surprised at how expensive kale chips are in the store. So if you're teaching kids how to make them at home,
I know.
I think that's a really good benefit.
Yeah, I feel like the store-bought kale chips are a little silly to me, because it's really something that's so easy to make at home if you have an oven. Like, anyone can do it. Small children can help tear up the kale leaves. It's such an accessible recipe that there's no need for anyone to be buying kale chips in the store. Just buy a bunch of kale and make your own.
And how do you make? Do you bake them in the oven?
Yep.
And just like lay them out on a tray?
Yeah, so you can tear them into bite-sized pieces or a little bit bigger than you want the actual chips to be, keeping in mind that they'll cook down a little bit.
Okay.
Sprinkle them with a little bit of olive oil. You can put salt on there, garlic powder, really whatever kind of seasoning you like. And then just spread it out in like an even layer on a baking sheet. And I think people have different opinions about what temperature to bake it at, but I think as long as you keep your eye on it and make sure that it doesn't burn or overcook, you're good. And just wait until it's crispy. And it's delicious and simple. And it's a great introduction to leafy greens for young kids, because it's crunchy and delicious.
I know. And it just amazes me that they're twice as expensive as potato chips. I just look at them. I'm like, oh, I'm going to try it. Oh, no, I'm not.
Yeah.
You know, when you see the price of them. So cool. I think that's a great way to teach kids. And it's so true. I mean, kids love to cook in the classroom. There's so much math that you do. Yeah. You know, it's introducing fractions when you start talking about measuring cups. And, you know, if you do any kind of like, you know, doubling the recipe, how much more are we going to need? I mean, there's tons of math, and I used to do a lot of cooking projects at Head Start. So, you know, you can start with pretty little kids. And like you said, all kids get excited about food, and they're hungry at school. You know, their brains are working. You want to keep them, you know, fed, and having nutritious snacks is important. I mean, when you're sitting there with a kid and you see how hard their brain's working when they're struggling with a math problem, or, you know, even writing sometimes for a long time, you know, especially like I said, I've got first graders now that, you know, they're trying to sound out words and figure things out. And sometimes after they've been writing for a while, you can just see that they're tired. They've used a lot. And so it's nice to have a little healthy snack. And then just, you know, there's so many benefits to them being in the garden, and getting to see that science happening right before them, and they can learn how to, you know, create a hypothesis and how to follow it through and how to draw diagrams, which I always think is a good, you know, visual, how to, you know, make things. And then, like you said, spacing and, you know, using a ruler or, you know, figuring out how many seeds per inch. And then there's always those little tiny carrot seeds that I hate that are so tiny that are good for those little hands. Tons of cool stuff. All right. Well, let me see. What's your favorite tool to use in the garden?
This is probably a lame answer. But I feel like whenever I'm in the garden, I end up using this little kind of hand cultivator. It looks like a chicken foot to do weeding a lot.
No way. Or just, that's one of my all-time favorite tools.
I don't know what's a cool garden tool to reference, but I feel like that's kind of my go-to. Doing a lot of weeding. I mean, I think there's always a different tool for the job, but that's been my go-to during the summer.
Mm-hmm. No, I love that. How about a book or like a magazine or anything?
So I actually had gotten as a gift from my uncle a book last year, and I think it was called maybe like The Market Gardener. Mm-hmm. And it was written by someone up in Quebec.
Yep.
And that was really wonderful. My uncle lives out in Los Angeles, but he bought land, I think maybe in Montana, and he is looking to do some homesteading after he retires in a few years. So he's been geeking out on garden resources, and that was one that he shared with me that I really liked.
Yeah, that's a great book. I bought that for my husband at the beginning of the year. It was recommended by this woman, Joyce Pinson, in Kentucky. And we've learned some great things. My husband poured right through that. And yeah, that's a super book. I think his name is like Jean Forte. Or I don't know how to say his name either. But yeah, it's a great book. All right, ready for my final question?
I hope so. Yeah.
Okay, Rebecca, here we go. It's kind of a doozy. Okay. If there's one change you would like to see to create a greener world, what would it be? For example, is there a charity or organization you're passionate about or project you'd like to see put into action? And that can be your own organization. What do you feel is the most crucial issue facing our planet in regards to the environment, either locally, nationally, or on a global scale?
Oh man, yeah, that is a doozy. And I think looking at global environmental issues, it's really easy to feel bummed out about them and kind of hopeless. But I feel like we have so many opportunities in educating these younger generations and making them stewards of the land and setting up our society for success and just helping kids be more conscious about their practices and how it relates to the environment. So I feel really strongly about early education in general, but I think starting off young kids thinking about gardening and cooking and environmental issues in general is probably one of our best bets for setting up the world for success. And yeah, I feel like there's a lot of despair in the news and scary things going on with climate change. But if we set up kids to, I guess giving them the tools to think about those issues in a holistic manner and get creative with them, and have them care, and all we can do is kind of set up them for success and hope for the best.
Absolutely. Okay, how about an inspirational tip or quote to help motivate listeners to reach into the dirt and start their own garden?
Do you want a quote from me or like one of my favorite quotes?
Either one.
Oh man.
Whatever you think that will inspire people to dig in that dirt and have fun with their kids.
Yeah, I mean, I guess my hope is that people don't really need an inspiring quote to do that. It's just, it's so fun and easy. And I think one of the easiest and most accessible ways of having a great experience with kids is going outside, whether that's gardening or walking in the woods. That's how you're going to get your kids hooked on nature early on. And if you're, I think if grown-ups are excited about something, kids are going to be excited about it too. So share your enthusiasm with students, and good things will always follow.
Perfect. That's a great way to end our interview. Do you want to tell listeners how to connect with you if they have any questions about getting their own program started or just anything they heard today?
Definitely. So again, my organization is Green Mountain Farm to School. We're on Facebook, and we have our website, gmfts.org, and my contact info is on there. And I love talking about food and gardens and all those good things. So I'm happy to touch base with anyone who has questions.
Awesome. Thank you so much for sharing with us today, Becca.
Yeah, thank you so much, Jackie.
Thank you for listening to the Organic Gardener Podcast. I'd like to encourage you to check out our website at organicgardenerpodcast.com. That's just organicgardenerpodcast.com. And you'll see the links to everything that we've talked about today in the show notes page and all the other episodes there. You can easily search for people by name. You can download our ebook on organic gardening basics and subscribe to our newsletter for updates and just different things that are going on. Thanks for listening, and remember to grow local.